Before we get stuck into this episode, I just want to give a massive shout out to a great pub in East Belfast, Hearth in Ballyhackamore. So Hearth is a pub that most people who live in East Belfast will know already, but basically it's the best place to watch rugby in East Belfast. It's at the heart of the community in Ballyhack. Hearth is a bit of a social hub. It's well kitted out with fantastic upstairs and downstairs areas. Bring your friends there, enjoy a drink, bring food in with you. If there's a game on, they'll have it up on the big screen. So I'm really excited to announce a partnership made in heaven between Hearth, which is the home of rugby in East Belfast, and the Red Hand podcast, which is the most listened to Ulster rugby podcast. We have loads planned. I'm really excited about it. Great partnership. This is just the beginning. So watch this space. Now on to the episode.
Welcome to the Red Hand podcast, the most listened to Ulster rugby podcast. The Red Hand is independent, made by fans, for fans. Next level Ulster rugby content featuring unrivaled insight, unfiltered opinion, powerful stories, and accessible analysis. If you're a business who would like to advertise to thousands of rugby fans across the province and beyond, please get in touch via Instagram at theredhand.co or email Peter at theredhand.co. Don't forget to follow us on socials and join in the discussion. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support us, please sign up to The Red Hand on Patreon. Also, please like and subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a rating and tell your friends. Put the link to the podcast in some of your group chats. Thanks for your support, and we hope you enjoy listening to this episode.
Welcome to the Red Hand podcast. We're well and truly at the business end of the season now. A hard-fought win over Benetton was vital in the hunt for playoff places. However, despite a number of positives, a less than perfect performance meant the Italian side left Belfast with two bonus points, which could yet prove significant in the battle for top eight. Ulster need a win over the Scarlets, and they'll be looking to get something from their games against provincial rivals Munster and Leinster to hopefully finish the season on a high. I sense nerve-wracking times over the next few weeks. As Ulster fans, we're used to the roller coaster of emotions across the season, mixed feelings and at times mixed messages. Indeed, interim head coach Richie Murphy's audition for the top job can't be made any easier by the distractions of other high-profile names being mentioned in the media. Seemingly everyone's clamouring to join the rebuild project Ulster. The entertaining Ulster rugby drama continues in these uncertain times for the province. To help make sense of the confusion, I'm joined by usual members of the panel, Nathan, Fergus and Ian. I'm delighted to say as well that we're joined by rugby journalist and author that I have a huge amount of respect for, Brendan Fanning. So great to have you with us, Brendan.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
And like, there aren't too many proper journalists about these days. So like, Brendan's someone who challenges, he questions, and he offers strong opinions. And we'll come to Brendan in a couple of minutes. But first, we'll do a bit of a recap previously on the Red Hand sort of contextualisation. Nathan, I'll ask you to do this. So talk to us about the Benetton game, maybe place it in context, this race to the top eight in the league, Richie Murphy's brief time in charge, and this this important run-in that we have.
Yeah, well, look, it was probably not as close a game as the scoreline suggests. Benetton kind of had a few consolations at the end that probably turned into something more than consolations. One of my personal favourite of which was when one of the replacement forwards managed to strip the ball from an Ulster player on his own line and fall over to score. That was probably one of the best scores I've seen all season. Yeah, look, you got to win your home games when you're battling for the way Ulster are for playoffs. And they're doing that in the last 2 weeks, albeit in less than convincing fashion. But look, Benetton are a good side, as we said last week. Ulster seventh now, level on points with Benetton and Connacht, a point ahead of Edinburgh in ninth. So look, you mentioned the games that are coming up. The Scarlets game should be something that they look to get something from, and look, who knows what Leinster are going to send up the road, depending on where their priorities lie, because that game is before the week before a potential Champions Cup final for them. So look, you'd have to say with those two home wins, things are looking pretty positive, because you know, anything from, you know, they could easily get eight points from the last three games, and that could easily be enough. So look, Richie Murphy is doing what he has to do, so to speak, for the run-in. And yeah, look, two much needed wins after what was a difficult tour to South Africa.
Thank you for that, Nathan. And look, speaking of Richie Murphy, I'd be interested, Brendan, to hear what have you made of Richie Murphy? Obviously, he's come in as the interim head coach, but given that sort of short time in charge that he's had, it probably is too early to judge him based on results or the performances even just yet. So do you think he's the right man for the job at Ulster?
This is a really difficult one, and I've given this a bit of thought when you gave me a heads up that we'd be talking about Richie's situation. I know Richie for years, and I think he has carved out a really good career for himself, starting off as doing a lot of skills coaching, working with the Ireland team, then having great success with the 20s. I think people don't appreciate this is Richie's first role as a head coach of an adult team. And to go into somewhere like Ulster, who are in desperate trouble, is a huge ask in the first place. So I guess that it becomes a little bit easier if he can crystallise in his own head exactly what he wants from this. But does Richie Murphy want to stay as Ulster head coach? Is he looking at this as an interim post where he sees them out to the end of the season, packs his bag and comes back down the M1, or does he hope to get a decent offer, move his family up? And those questions can't be answered until he sits down with, I guess, Brent Cunningham, Hugh McCaughey and whoever else is involved in the decision-making process there. And he does his list of pros and cons. So I think he has brought a measure of organisation, and anything new after the era that was going before is going to be good. And Richie's done a decent job. I think it is very hard at this stage to assess whether he is what Ulster want, because I'm not sure Ulster can afford what they really want. And until they answer that question themselves, nobody really knows.
Interesting. So yeah, I suppose I'd probably previously been working on the assumption that Richie wants the job, but that's not necessarily the case. He might, after a couple of months in Ulster, he might decide he's better off returning to a similar role to what he'd been doing previously. And I think certainly in this podcast and any fans I've spoken to, you know, I think we're all sort of behind Richie. You know, I certainly am, on the basis that he seems like he's brought positivity, a change in atmosphere to Ulster, which is desperately needed. So just reflecting on the game on Friday, look, lots of ups and downs, and in the spirit of balance that we usually try and bring to this podcast, Fergus, do you want to give us two good, two bad from the game on Friday?
Yeah, I'll get into that. I'm interested in that opinion on Richie Murphy, because that's the first time I've actually considered he might not want the job. You know, I sort of taken it almost like a given. Of course you want to come to coach Ulster in the head coaching role. So that's a slightly different slant. But like, was it Jason Lear on last week, the rugby analyst, was talking about the importance of not having interim people, you know, with both CEO and head coach, the importance of getting people appointed permanently. So like, it'd be great if even though this week with a week off, they could try and get that position clarified and get Richie in place. But yeah, the match on Friday going by, I actually attended obviously with yourself, Peter. He didn't get as much fanfare as I expected going in. But
very disappointing.
Great to have you back inside the ground, and I'm sure momentum will grow in terms of support for you going back. And it was actually, compared to the Cardiff game the week before, I thought the atmosphere was a bit more lively right from the start. Fans behind the players. In terms of the good and the bad from the game, start with the bad, because the game that they won, so there's plenty of positives from it as well. The one standout bad moment I thought in that game was like the rugby equivalent of an own goal, whenever Addison made a wonderful break towards the halfway line and decided to flick the ball back inside the nobody. And I think it was Tana Umanga's cousin who picked up and ran in a try. And it was like, it's a crucial part of the game. You know, it was like quite early second half. Ulster built up a really good lead. And that was just a really good way to turn the tide slightly back towards Benetton. But with that being said, I actually thought Addison played well on the whole. It was just a bit of a moment that ended up, like, it really was like a rugby equivalent of an own goal. The other negatives, I couldn't believe in the first 10 minutes or so how many times Ulster got turned over. I thought the start of the game really concerningly. Like, I thought Benetton looked like they were on course for a win. Every time Ulster got the ball and took it into contact, they were snapping over and jackling and getting the ball. Thankfully, that seemed to sort of sort itself out after the first 10 minutes or so. I think I count 4 turnovers in the first 10 minutes just watching. And then the defence as well. In a game where you concede 5 tries, you can't really claim to have defended particularly well. But Ulster are one of 2 sport teams that I kind of follow closely and support. And to draw a quick parallel, Manchester United and Ulster aren't very dissimilar, because Man United had a game at the weekend where they drew 1-1 with Burnley, which is a pretty disappointing, you know, home result against 19th in the table. But after the game, Erik ten Hag described them as one of the league's most entertaining and dynamic teams. Ulster are almost like the equivalent. You know, that game on Friday night for a neutral was a great watch, but not because you were watching 2 really good, well-polished teams. You're watching 2 teams. It was the same in the first game of the season. There was a very similar scoreline. I think it was something like 5 tries each. And only came down to the fact that Ulster kicked their goals exactly the same as this time. And Ulster haven't got into a really good winning position at half time to only win by 4 points. It was very typical Ulster. Very typical that they didn't see the game and manage the game. And there was quite a lot of errors both sides. However, coming on to the good points, scoring 5 tries for one thing, and some of the tries were actually good tries. You know, there was a good bit of creativity and variety in the play, and actually good character having conceded an early try to come back. And it was a spark from John Cooney making a break, offloading the ball with a successfully executed back flick onto Tom Stewart to go 7-0 early on in the game. So I thought that they actually mix up their play between Cooney and Billy Burns very well throughout the game. Their attacking play was generally more expansive than we've probably seen for most of this season. And I thought the standout player was pretty obvious. The player of the match was John Cooney. So he kicked all the conversions, kicked the penalty, which ultimately is what won the game. He made a try-saving tackle at a crucial stage of the game as well. So, you know, getting the cross into the corner. And, you know, it really was a try-saving tackle at a crucial stage of the game. He got his assist. You know, so really he was like a one-man band nearly for parts on Friday. So it was brilliant to see him back to something like his best. Other standout performers, I was looking at the stats again. I'd like to check the stats these days, the Ulster game. So most carries in the game was Tom Stewart. Thought Tom Stewart had a good game after a ropey enough couple of months for him. Thought he had a good game. The set piece was a lot better. Jacob Stockdale as well carried very strongly. He was the next highest with 17 carries in the game and 4 line breaks. And actually, although they didn't start the game well, if you do look at the stats of the game, Ulster had more carries with 149 to 122. Actually had slightly less line breaks, which is 7-9. But they had the edge and territory. They had more possession. They had a 92% success rate in their lineouts, which must be probably the highest of the season, which isn't saying much, but the lineout actually seemed to function quite well the other night. Penalties conceded was pretty even, but 7 from Ulster, 6 to Benetton. Bennett had more defending to do. 143 tackles by Ulster, 207 by Treviso. And actually, interestingly, though, and it goes back to the point about defence, Ulster actually apparently missed 36 tackles to Benetton's 26. So definitely some rough edges there. I think you can see with Ulster, there's potential there. There's good players. But I think going back to the original point, you know, if you're talking about a well-coached, well-drilled team, that's where you need to have a head coach, if it's Richie Murphy, in place and give him time. And I suppose there's no quick fixes to that. And I think also the point was made last week in the podcast, you need to give a coach a good couple of seasons in order to develop their own squad, get the recruitment right, bring in the right people in the right positions. So a slow build, but it did show again the potential that's there. You know, when, like Man United, Ulster, you know, have mismanaged a lot of their funds and a lot of their spending in recent times, but they've got people in higher positions, starting from CEO down, that hopefully can start making some sane, rational, joined-up choices. So you can see the raw potential on the pitch, but the chaos of that game probably reflected it's not a well-coached team yet. You know, when I was going to come on to it there, the scrum percentage, probably as a result of the fact that it was nearly a new front row, but 57% win percent in the scrum is not a great statistic. The scrum was under a lot of pressure during that game. So, yeah, there you go. More good than bad, but chaos on the rugby pitch.
Yeah, entertaining chaos, I have to say. But, good and bad from that. And Ian, turning to you now, we've been on here, and some people say we paint an overly pessimistic picture. I disagree. I think we're fairly realistic throughout the season. So I want to ask you, what are the reasons for hope and optimism for Ulster fans at the minute?
Oh, that's a curveball. Yes, we're always pessimistic. We're always realistic. I think to answer your question, we have the makings of a very good and young squad. We're starting to see a bit of a leadership coming through with McCann, Sheridan, even Stewart in the forwards. We've always had good leaders in the backs with Hume and Stewart McCluskey, and I thought Cooney's leadership on Friday night was superb, and that was something, not just his all round play, but I think just him controlling things was a difference between that performance and some of the earlier performances. I know he got man of the match, and his all round game was really, really good, but he looked as though he was shouldering a bit more responsibility than what he had done previously. His shoulders are squared a bit more, not slumped, playing with a bit more of a smile on his face. And I think, you know, if we can get John Cooney playing like that for the rest of the season, there's certainly a bit of hope. Very impressed with, I know the stat doesn't say a lot in the scrum, but I'm very impressed with that young pack of forwards. And obviously these guys are going to learn a bit. And they're having to do it on the hoof at the minute because of injuries. Scott Wilson was like a young form of Tadhg Furlong at some stages during that game. Basically pushing people out of his way and running over the top of people. He has issues in the scrum, but he's 21, he's going to get better at that as he's coached. We always come back to that coaching ticket. If the right people are in place, these guys will definitely be in the frame for honours, I would have thought, in the seasons to come. So very, very optimistic with the young guys that we have there. And, looking at the back three that we had out there on Friday night, Lowry, Stockdale and Balakoon, all back to, getting back to their best form and doing things that we expect them to do. Particularly, I thought Balakoon, he was soaring into the air after high balls, where a couple of months ago he was standing on the ground waiting for the opposition to catch the ball and drop. Now he's getting up along with them and winning the ball. And that's just a one wee difference that we've seen since Richie come in. Richie Murphy knows how Rob Balakoon can be contributing to that team. He's obviously had a word with him. Same with Stockdale. Stockdale's now carrying like he was carrying three or four seasons ago, breaking through tackles and just using his strength to get us through. And it's no surprise that he got in the end of that kick from Stuart McCluskey to get his try. So yeah, I'm pretty pessimistic. Tough games still to come. I'm quite aware of that, but I think confidence is coming back.
Sorry, Ian. Pessimistic or optimistic?
Oh, pessimistic.
Oh, pessimistic. I was just double checking because you sounded quite hopeful. But not hopeful enough.
No, I'm only joking. I'm always optimistic, Peter. You know that.
Of course, I know that. Sorry, Nathan. Good to you now.
I just want to go back to that big picture stuff. I've been thinking about this ever since Brendan said it. The point about Richie and whether he does or doesn't want it. He was talking in the press and remarkably, he kind of actually, first of all, he told everyone his son was talking to Ulster, which I thought was a very bizarre thing to do, to make that acknowledgement. But obviously he said he's talking to them as well. I mean, if he was in a flat out, I'm not really sure about this, would he be acknowledging that, yeah, he's talking to Ulster and the decisions are being made? Or do you think that's kind of just something he has to say because he can't come out publicly and say, nah, not for me at this stage, because it's too early in?
Well, I think you're right. He's already going to come out and rule himself out of the job whenever he's still there in his interim. But I definitely get the feeling that he wants it. Maybe that's ill-placed.
The other thing to consider is they're in transfer talks with people. Like, can you really be having conversations with young kids like Jack Murphy if you're not the one who's going to be there the next year? Now, he didn't say it was him specifically that was talking about signing him, but there's been discussion, rumours about other signings as well. I mean, I don't know. It just seems strange for Ulster to be doing what they're doing at the minute and making the moves they're making and people making the comments they're making in the press if he's absolutely not going to stay next year. Someone wants to jump in.
Yeah, I don't think there are any absolutes in this at this point. And obviously, Richie's not going to say, Jesus, lads, this is brutal. I'm having a miserable time. And I'm going to tell my son to go anywhere but Ulster. I think the key decision regarding Jack Murphy is what's best for Jack Murphy, whether his outlet is there or not. And the queue ahead of Jack Murphy and Leinster is substantial, so I think it's a given that Jack Murphy is going to Ulster. Whether or not his own man is there when he arrives depends on, from one week, what they make of Richie in the short term and what Richie makes of them. So if I'm Richie Murphy, the first thing I'd be saying to Hugh McCaughey is, when you took over as interim CEO, you said, whilst the post is an interim appointment, I don't see it as a case of holding the reins. Ulster Rugby has recently faced challenges, but it is my belief that in the coming months we can achieve much and also lay the foundations for future success. So if I was Richie, I'd say, well, okay, Hugh, tell us, how are you going to do this? How much money have you got to spend? Who are we going to go after? What positions do we need to fill on the playing field? Because we're losing quality in Burns and Addison and seemingly not replacing like with like, if with anything. And critically, what do Ulster expect next season? If they can't go to the market with any serious wedge to get the players at 7 and at 10 and with 3 and at 1 that they want, then they're going to have to cut their cloth. And if they cut their cloth, then the chances of success are very limited. And it's a difficult message to convey to the Ulster supporters who have suffered for many years without any silverware and start every season thinking, maybe this is the year, maybe this is the year. So before they even troop down the Ravenhill Road, if you say, by the way, lads, it's great that you're buying season tickets, but we ain't going to be meaning anything, but I'd like you to stay supporting us nonetheless. So this really is quite a conundrum. And then you have the situation between Ulster and the mothership. So currently, Leinster clearly are awash with cash. Munster, they probably will secure a home draw, will get a good payday out of that. That'll help their financials. They're not doing too badly as it is. And Connacht are not far off the pace. Ulster, meanwhile, are over 2 million quid. And my understanding is that the IRFU are expecting Ulster to knock on the door and say, look, lads, we need a bit of a dig out here. And I think the IRFU probably have no choice other than to give them the dig out. But with the dig out will come some pretty strict demands as to how the business should be run on and off the field. And that all ties into whether it's an attractive job for a head coach or not. I'd say Richie Murphy is saying to himself, first of all, I want to go up there and make a reasonable impression, see if I can do something with these fellas. Secondly, I need to look at the environment in which they're asking me to do it. If they ask me to do the job next season, I need to look at the nuts and bolts of what that job is going to look like. I would say in his gut, he is saying, yeah, I want to stay. How many times am I going to get offered a head coaching gig like this? And in my opinion, the Ulster job is a big job because I've always considered Ulster to be, as in football parlance, a big football club. They have the stadium, they have the support base, they have something that the other three provinces don't have, which is a unique identity. And by a unique identity, I mean an identity with a political overtone to it. I remember years ago reporting on Ulster in Biarritz in a European game. I don't know why I was sent to it, because the interest for the Sunday window of the 240 copies of you would have sold north of the border, I'd say eight of them would have been interested in rugby. But nevertheless, I was sent over to Biarritz to cover this game. So I'm out that night with the Ulster contingent of a print and broadcast journals and a couple of others. And there's about 10 of us around the table. And we had a great night, and there's the usual banter back and forth. And I was slagging the lads off for being card-carrying Ulster fans, even though they were journos. And one of them said to me, I'll never forget it. He says, "You don't understand," he said. "This is our team. It's not like it for you. You're in Dublin. You're writing about different provinces and you're writing about Leinster. This is our team." I was getting the look as he said it. And it is definitely a different vibe to the other three provinces. And for that reason, Ulster have an awful lot going for them. You can't create something like that. You can't just get onto the marketing department and say, magic me up an identity. They have it. But Jesus, have they messed it up horrifically for the last, I don't know how many years. And if I'm in the IRFU and I'm opening the biscuit tin with the cash in it, I say, lads, I ain't giving you a dime here until you can show me how you can turn this around. And by turn it around, I mean off the field, on the field, everything. Because there is something culturally wrong with Ulster and has been for quite some time.
And I want to return to that, Brendan, in a moment. Look, there's so much to take from what you said there. I think one of the most interesting points is simply that you're obviously, given your job and your career to date, you're very analytical whenever you look at these situations. I have to say, I was hook, line and sinker when Hugh McCackie started talking about the good old days and mentioning some of the my favourite players over the years. I was very much on board immediately. But crucially, he needs to say how he's going to achieve that, how he's going to bring back the culture, the values and the success that we once had. And I will return to that, but I want to ask sort of the panel now, there has been this talk, as usual, of a rebuild at Ulster, where I'm sick of that phrase, but we're a team in transition, probably more through necessity than design, just a lack of budget. We're going to have to rely on young players, which is a good thing. Do you know, it's one of those, I've talked before about a crisis-tunity, a crisis and an opportunity meet, and you end up with this crisis-tunity where we're forced to play young players, and there's that consensus from both fans and seemingly now the higher-ups at Ulster Rugby. Rather than signing all these big names, the World Cup winners, it's maybe more prudent and pragmatic to bring through these promising young guys. So long-winded intro to my question, is it wise at this stage? And would you be content as Ulster fans, for the Ulster fans on the panel, and Nathan's an honorary Ulster fan, of course, would it be wise to sacrifice short-term success for potential long-term gains in that regard?
I do believe that Bryn Cunningham, just after Dan McFarlane was sacked, Bryn Cunningham actually said that Ulster fans need to sort of dial back the expectations a wee bit. We do, I think, start every season, think we're going to win everything. That's just a relic of the past and haven't had good teams. But yes, Peter, I would say that we're going to have to accept, for some of the reasons that Brendan just said there, we don't have the money to go to the open market and bring in these better players. You know, the people that we discussed last week, you know, are under 20s, young guys starting out in a professional career. So, I think as Ulster fans, we need to be thinking about, you know, where we are at the moment and the struggle to qualify for a top eight position rather than where we were 3 or 4 years ago when we were looking at maybe getting to semi-finals and finals.
Yeah. It's quite stark whenever you hear it spelt out from outside the Ulster bubble we're used to operating in, because I think maybe we could be guilty sometimes of being, I don't think this is a pessimistic podcast, it's probably overly optimistic sometimes, and you maybe, even the likes of again Jason coming on last week and talking about what we need and talking about how we need to get a world-class seven, and I was sort of watching Ulster thinking, Dave McCann? I mean, Dave McCann's away for it, but then maybe not a natural seven, and maybe not world class, you know, if you're talking about those levels. And I think maybe we can be a bit guilty of maybe over-egging some of our talent. I definitely think there is talent there. But I think, and again, in this podcast, Dan's made the point, I think the fan base, if it was communicated to us that this is the situation, we are in dire financial straits, our recruitment is not going to include, you know, top budget world-class players, and we're going to be investing in youth. Now, you always need to have a balance, because it's not fair to take, you know, 19 to 21 year olds and throw them into, you know, top level, you know, ERC rugby. You need to have that balance of experience in there as well. But if that was communicated, I don't think Hugh McCaughey's improved since he's come in, but the communication about exactly what situation Ulster are in has not been good from those executive levels. And again, it's a really interesting slant to think of it. You know, Richie Murphy, like I said earlier, I just assumed, well, of course he's going to want the Ulster job, because in my mind, Ulster's a big, it is a big team, it's a big province. But actually, he'd be mad not to be asking those questions. You know, if he wasn't looking for assurances about exactly what he has to work with, what kind of budget there is available to him, and is it going to be managed sensibly in the next 2 to 3 years, so he can at least then make plans and provisions. So all of that is, it's a very interesting perspective to hear. And like I say, I'm probably as guilty as the next of thinking, well, we've loads of talent, but it is a bit terrifying if you think we're going to lose probably, what, 10 players this summer. You need to replace them. And it would be nice if the club could communicate exactly what they say the situation being. And the truth might be they don't know, because they might be hoping for a bailout and don't know if they're going to get it or not. But yeah, no, really, really interesting to hear those perspectives. I'm slightly worried now.
Yeah, I know. It seems we're overly positive in this podcast, and we get
What I would say there on the what Brendan said about the IRFU waiting to hear what Ulster are going to ask for. If they haven't asked for it by now, I'd be very, very disappointed. I would have thought, even in the first week that McCaughey's there, that he's knocking on the door of the IRFU to say, look, let's sit down, let's discuss what we need here. I understand that this, you know, they have to put some sort of a proposal together, but if you don't know what you're expecting to get, it's very difficult to go with that cap, isn't it?
It's a great opportunity to blame it on the guys before. You can just, you know, go cap in hand and say, here, listen, Petrie, what was he doing? You know, we'll have it together now. A couple of million, we'll sort it out. But you know, what were they doing? You only get to say it's my first day for one day, you know. So, yeah, missed opportunity if they haven't.
Yeah. And Humphreys is there, of course. So you'd like to think he'd be kindly disposed towards Ulster as well. But that remains to be seen.
I'm still waiting to see how that one pans out. It shouldn't be too long now until we see the effects of that. It may well be completely the opposite, Peter.
He's the most important man for you. And the coincidence is it's like Hollywood-esque. If you go back to the press conference in Ravenhill with Brian McLaughlin, I've never, ever seen such an awkward situation. So much distance between two men sitting about 6 inches away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You can go back to that and say, okay, Humph, if you want to do us a favour, you need to start rattling a few cages in Leinster and Munster and Connacht, and particularly Leinster, and say, sorry, Leo, you've got about 5 loose end props there. You're going to have to let one of them go. And to get back to the bigger picture stuff, it beggars belief that a province of Ulster size has so few people playing rugby. Like, people talk about the 6 counties. Last time I checked, there were 9. I don't know how much rugby is going on in the other 3. I don't know. I've gone through the usual suspects on the school scene, and I'm wondering why are there no new schools pushing through. If you look at Leinster, for example, it is still dominated by hardcore 6 or 7 schools who win the trophy. Gonzaga now have broken into that. But by a distance, the key factor in Leinster is not just what the likes of Michaels and Rock and now Gonzaga are doing, plus Belvoir, Clongers and Terenure. The key difference for Leinster is that the middle order schools, of whom there would be roughly a dozen, all of them have serious rugby programs. Nearly all of them have an arrashers of a chance of getting to St. Patrick's Day, but all of them are producing one or two players now who go into the pro scene. So not only do you have the hardcore, the usual suspects, but now you've got another bunch who don't have silverware to show, but the likes of Gerrards and St. Andrews, and you know, you guys have benefited from Andrews. Greg Jones came out of Andrews. Andrews wouldn't win a school's cup in a fit. So all of these fellas are now hovering around Donnybrook, trying to get in, trying to get a gig. And they're brought in on day one, and they're given for example, they put together the 17s and 18 squads to train over this coming summer. They sat them down, and they gave them a video presentation, telling them basically how good we are. This is what we do. X number of this percentage of our players go on to play to get full contracts. This percentage go on to play for Ireland. This percentage go on to play for the Lions. So the lads all come out the door going, Jesus, we've landed on our feet here. This is the best province in the world. And the rest, well, it isn't, clearly. But people are saying, my God, why is Jordy Barrett going to Leinster? It's really bloody obvious why Jordy Barrett is going to Leinster. Why wouldn't he? He'll have a fantastic time there for 6 months, playing with top-of-the-range players, getting well-coached, in a really good environment, earning good coin. What's not to like? I look at Ulster and I think a province with the tradition of Ulster and the size of Ulster, and they're punching so far below their weight, it is unreal.
Yeah, yeah. And coming back to that sort of bigger picture stuff, Brendan, in previous episodes of this podcast, we've talked about the fixes for Ulster rugby. And that's one of them. I think the player pool is a massive issue, and I think we're missing out just because in Ulster, not exclusively, but predominantly, rugby is a sport played by middle-class Protestants from the same select group of schools. But the Sullivan, by the way, are now very good. They're playing. they're producing players. And as you know, Brendan, Willie Anderson kick-started that process with his involvement at Sullivan, and it's been continued now. But in terms of what we need to do at Ulster, this is the million-dollar question. We've talked about the much-needed shift in culture and values that define Ulster rugby, but if you were in charge, and we've talked about the various problems that there are, but if you were in charge, what would be the most obvious significant fixes you would identify?
Oh. Stumped.
the culture is number one, and I could partly because of my personality type, I couldn't just do one thing. I would try to do five things at the same time, and I would just go back over everything I've said. I would start with the culture, because the culture is a dangerous word. It is a much abused word, and I think people don't understand what culture is. For my money, in a sporting context, culture is what other people think of you. So every time you go to play a match, and I'm involved in coaching at juvenile level, and I would hope that every time you wrap up and go home, I haven't played somebody, if you were to ask the other coaches or the other kids, what did you make of that lot? But they would say, yeah, they play decent rugby, they're sound enough guys, they're very tough about what they do. You know, they come across as decent, but very hard working. That's what your culture should be. And it extends to everything you do on and off the field. And you need team leaders to pick people up on it when they're not living the way you want to live. I would ask myself, if I'm Peter Lockhart or Ian Frizzell, these guys are big businessmen in Belfast or Derry or wherever, and I want to get them to invest in my operation, what do I have to do to make my business more attractive to these fellas, to get them to invest in what I do? Work that out. Keep asking yourself, why? Why am I doing this? Is it going to make us better? And if you keep asking yourself that question, and you're honest with yourself on the answer, things gain a degree of clarity. They don't necessarily become easier. Ask yourself, why is it we have 9 counties and 1.5 of them play rugby? Why is it we are, as you said, Peter, we are still locked into that private, middle-class, prod, rugby-playing cohort? how many, I don't know, you lads tell me, I was always struck during the Troubles by the number of kids who did their A-levels in those schools in Belfast, grabbed their bit of paperwork, ran to the airport or to the ferry and went to Scotland, to Edinburgh or to Newcastle or wherever. What percentage of those kids are still gathering their stuff and leaving as soon as they're done with second level education? Because if your game is based in those private schools and a chunk of them are leaving, how can you stop that? How can we get more Catholics playing the game? How can we get more immigrants playing the game? The great weakness of Irish rugby, for my money, is its profile. Skinny white guys who go to private school. And if you look at the culture, the way we have changed culturally across the island, it beggars belief how we are not doing more to get players of colour who are genetically gifted to get them involved in our game. Okay, that's quite a bit for you to chew on, but that's what I would be trying to do. And the good news is it's a really quick fix. It only takes 6 months.
Sorry, Nathan. Nathan, do you want to come in on that at all? No, it's just we've had previous conversations about different ways of incentivizing young players to stay. As you say, there's this massive, really called it the brain drain before, but we're more concerned about the rugby talent drain from Ulster and incentivizing people to stay. It's funny and it's, but I think actually really relevant. I would cover the Belfast Giants, who are a massive success story in Northern Ireland and Ulster, you know, in terms of it's very cross community. And actually all the players I've spoken to have been attracted to come to Belfast, which isn't historically a massive ice hockey hub, has been they're offered an education in Belfast. They're set up with various courses that they want to study. They're funded through those courses. And Ulster they've made tentative steps towards a relationship with Queen's University, but they need more of that. They need players. Players will want something to fall back on. And I think that's one obvious way of you know, keeping people hanging about in Northern Ireland, in Ulster rather, to play the rugby here rather than necessarily going abroad. And there's as you say, like there's plenty of other fixes that we need. But yeah, that remains to be seen. And Hugh McCackie will hopefully at least start those. But as you say, 6 months isn't a long time to do anything significant. Look, in terms of, I actually had a listener question which I thought was quite interesting, and I'd invite the panel's views on this. Stephen McCormick asks, what are the panel's views of having a director of rugby and a head coach, like in bringing in a new director of rugby? Is that needed for a better development strategy and a more objective performance assessment of coaches and players? So this is someone, I suppose, director of rugby, my understanding of it is someone who sort of manages that side of things, the player relationships, the rugby side of things, and allow the sort of the business people to go on, do what they do. What do you guys think of that? I floated the idea of bringing Justin Harrison back, who's done great work for the Australia, for the rugby, the Australian Rugby Union. So, and Ulster legend, of course. What do you guys think of that director of rugby role?
It's a wee bit like it's become the commonplace. It's like the norm in football again now, isn't it? To have a director of football, in this case, director of rugby, to give you some sort of continuity so that if a head coach does change what we were talking about earlier, so your values and your culture shouldn't change because you're going to try and appoint another coach with those same values, and it gives you a measure of continuity. But the problem being, you need to appoint the correct director of rugby. You're going to do that, so you need to make a good thorough process and make sure it's going to be someone who is invested in the team and invested in the province. But going back to all those points, I think we've had these conversations before in the podcast. Like Ulster rugby has definitely been poorly run for at least a decade now, and there's a lot of damage to try and repair. And grassroots, it's not going to be a quick fix, but grassroots is probably where that needs to start happening. And the easy wins, but you might not see the benefits for another 10 years, would be going out to primary and secondary schools and trying to get kids who aren't traditionally involved playing rugby. It won't be for everyone. Like my wife's a primary school teacher, out towards Rathcoole, Newton Abbey. Wouldn't be a particularly traditional rugby playing area. And to be fair, there was someone from Ulster Branch who went in and played tag rugby with a bunch of P7s. And after the first session, he sat them all down and said, well, what did you all think of that? And one wee kid just went, not for us. So, you know, not everyone's going to be won over, but at least they tried. Because rugby isn't for everyone. But you will get people. You go out to the, you know, schools, there's a whole huge catchment area. And there'll be kids who absolutely love it. Because there's kids who love, get, you know, it can be an aggressive sport. Not everyone's into football and the theatrics and the rolling around in the ground. There will be kids who absolutely love it, who just don't get the opportunity to play. And it's not that hard to roll it out there to get, you know, a rugby development officer at least in each county to go out to each school and set up some sort of program where you can go out and give kids a chance and get them fed into local rugby clubs. And there just isn't a great operation in Ulster for doing that. And that is the way forward, but it's not a quick fix, and it needs to be driven by Ulster Branch and from Ulster Rugby to promote the game within Ulster, and not just Northern Ireland. Good point. You know, branch it out those extra three counties as well.
Absolutely. It's funny you say that the kind of whole Ulster, because I just remember I had a mate who played for Donegal, and I think, I don't know what, Donegal Town Rugby Club or whatever it was called, and like he was pretty good as a kid. Like, he did underage Ulster stuff. But he'd have to drive from Donegal to Belfast to go to these sessions. He was like, I think he was in like Hume and Lowry's age group. So he was training with some of those lads. And it just got to the stage where his parents just said, look, we can't do this twice a week. Do you know what I mean? And I know that's probably a problem all over the shop in terms of like all the provinces have differences between clubs and travel. But there's something like that. Like, I don't know, it's not an easy necessarily drive from, you know, Donegal to Belfast. And I just wonder, like, how do you come across and deal with those problems? And I don't know, you know, I know down in Munster, use Cork and Limerick as kind of as bases as well. Leinster is slowly starting to branch out away from Dublin a little bit in terms of some of their representative underage sides. But I don't know if Ulster are doing that. Like, this is what, nearly 10 years ago now. So that's just, you know, one thing, the geography and the travel and the roads are a significant factor. And it just struck me because I just remember a friend of mine be saying, yeah, he just couldn't be arsed driving, what was it, two and a half hours each way or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's why I didn't play for Ulster. It was too long a drive for me.
But there isn't a good setup. Like, Ulster rugby is all focused towards schools. There's not a big scene of club youth rugby. And I think particularly when you get outside of Belfast, you know, you could have sort of more like hubs where, like, if you are going out to schools, if there's kids who are absolutely loving, you know, the tag rugby sessions you put on, or an older, you know, secondary school, get them signposted to the local rugby club and sort of swell the numbers and get more competitive games for sort of, you know. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Can I come in there?
Yeah.
We had a tournament at Ballymoney on Saturday. It was a second year memorial for my son-in-law, and it's a youth tournament. We had 120 boys, under 14s. At Ballymoney on Saturday, we had 60 girls under 13 at Ballymoney on Saturday. Barely any of those are connected with any of the bigger grammar schools. They're all coming through on the secondary school stream. Yeah. It was amazing to see the quality of the rugby that was played at under 14 level on Saturday. Mm-hmm. There are green shoots there. Ulster Rugby are involved. They're not involved as much as I would like to see them involved. But some of those boys already, a friend of mine, his son, I was having a chat with him, who had played centre for, you know, for through the minis or whatever they played up to under 14 level. And now he's been moved into hooker. So there is recognition there. There are things happening out there. It's slow. But I think there is a certainly in our area and at that level. And, you know, we had teams there from Larne, we had teams from Strabane, from Ballymena, from Corrine. So, you know, it's happening. Hopefully that it continues to happen and gets the backing that's needed.
Yeah.
I know My dad was saying about Estonians rugby club as well. I forget the numbers, but he said like it was for their under 14s, I think, and they had something like 45 players down playing, and very few of them being from like from Inst or those Belfast grammar schools. You know, it was more from like high schools locally.
Yeah,
and they employ like a development officer, so he's going out proactively. And I think if you had more of that province wide, you're increasing the pool of players. Then, you know?
That's the thing. Ballymoney took on a full time development officer 2 years ago, and Saturday was part of the fundraising we got generous sponsorship from Chris's former employers. And it's part of the fundraising to raise his salary each year. And he's going into the schools. He's working with the kids in the schools in the area and trying to promote the game of rugby in secondary schools, which was never done, in my opinion.
Sorry, one last point. But I know like a lot of fans sort of know that within the Ulster rugby scene, there's a fair bit of like nepotism, you know, like, oh, you know, there's favoured people that go in from the very start who know the right people or have come through the right school and have a greater chance of success, you know, and that kind of culture needs to be sort of gotten rid of. You know, it needs to be drawn from all available resources and given from the earliest possible age a good level of coaching, you know, across the board, whether it be through schools or through clubs.
That's a really interesting point, and I have noticed actually whenever a school gets a, I'm not making any specific accusations, but whenever a school gets a new head of rugby who's really well connected, you start to see guys come through. And not through, I'm not saying there's a lack of talent there, but as you say, there probably are people slip through the net because maybe their coach doesn't recommend them to the Ulster schools coach or whatever. Do you know?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure it happens everywhere, but we can't afford to let people slip through the net in the same way that maybe Leinster can. Do you know, we need everyone. I need to ask this question because it made me chuckle, and it was asked on Twitter. In light of Billy Vunipola's 2 taser takedown, which Ulster player, past or present, would require the most tasers to stop them in their tracks? So so Ian, I think I stuck this in the WhatsApp group, full disclosure. Ian had the best answer, I think. Who is it, Ian?
That was Big Nick Williams would be the one I would think for sure.
It's very hard to argue with that.
It's exactly what should be on the Ulster social media pages, stuff like this. Like proper experiments. Like doing for real. Even Stephen Ferris would be up for it, I would say.
He'd be up for it. Marty Moore would be pretty good. Any advance on that? I don't know how long we'll spend on this question, maybe.
Just keep naming thing rugby players.
I honestly think it would be someone mad. I think it would be a Neil Best, maybe, or even Neil McMillan. Remember him? He's a bit mad, do you know?
Well, I did suggest on the WhatsApp group that Ryan Caldwell, for different reasons, might have been difficult to stop.
Great lad, Ryan Caldwell, and friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod.
Yeah. And Ian, he asked actually a better question, given that apparently the first taser struck Billy Vunipola's wallet, which makes it slightly less impressive. What player, past or present, would have a wallet big and fat enough to withstand the taser? And I think that's a good question as well. So we're talking, I'm trying to think, probably Andrew Maxwell's done it all right out of Boozum, I'd say.
Ferris is doing pretty well on the punditry field. He's still able to play a couple of games of golf every week.
Stephen Kitchoff has done all right as well, hasn't he?
That's right. Yes, certainly has.
I think Paytow would be the top man for that wallet.
That's right. He's probably the best answer. Like, just as we wrap up here, Brendan, I was going to ask you. And this is really, hopefully we'll be able to finish on a positive note here. In terms of an outside perspective, and Ulster, you've given us that, and there's this never-ending soap opera-style drama at Ulster, the inconsistent performances, the perilous financial situation, Dan and Petrie both going this season. I think we've definitely become a basket case again, But my question to you is the only way up? Or do you think things might get worse for a season or two if you had to predict? What do you think?
Did he leave us?
The only way is up. And okay, you might go sideways for a while, but once you figure out what up looks like, there was somebody in Ulster I was talking to a couple of days ago about this, you know, the kind of the soap opera, the never ending saga. And he said, problem up here is, he said, we're not sure what good looks like anymore. And I said, okay, that kind of resonated. So yeah, I believe for the reasons I pointed out earlier on, the fact that there is a lot of the building blocks are in place, the fan base and the facilities and the stadium and the tradition, you can't magic up some of them, but you have them already. And I would hope that you have reached a tipping point whereby you got to figure out how things can get better. But you'd be crazy to start stamping your feet if after 7, 8, 9 games next season, you're down in the bargain basement scrapping for survival. You're going to go through some tough times, that's for sure. That's positive, anyway.
I would agree with that view. I thought 2 seasons ago that we were going to have a bit of a struggle in the league, and I think more by good luck than good management that we did get to home quarter final, albeit losing to Connacht. But I would agree with Brendan now. The expectations for next season and maybe the season after, we should not be thinking that we're anywhere near certainly home quarter final status, and that our battles next season will be similar to what our battle is at the moment, and getting into the playoffs. We are probably a mid table side at the moment, and we're among some pretty decent mid table sides. And we've seen week to week how that can change just by one result. So that's my expectation, anyway.
Yeah, fair. And look, as we finish, I just want to ask predictions of the panel for the last few games, the run-in. So let me remind myself. So yes, Scarlets, and then Munster and Leinster. So guys, in a sentence or two, I'll go through each of you. What do you predict in terms of outcome at the end of the season? Top 8 or maybe not? So who wants to go first?
I'll be overwhelmingly positive and say yes to top 8. I think you get a bounce out of Ravenhill last weekend. The Scarlets are in a desperate state, so you'll get 5 there, and that'll lift your boat. And thereafter depends on the selections that are put out against you, whether you have a chance or not, but you'll get a bounce out of that.
Thank you, Brendan. Thanks, appreciate Brendan. Like the positivity. And Nathan, do you want to go?
Yeah, I agree. I think Scarlett's a bit of a basket case, even if it's away from home. And yeah, in all likelihood, Leinster the week before a Champions Cup match in Ravenhill. Look, will Leinster too try to make some of the same mistakes as they did last year and play the second string too much? I don't know, but that's something that they should at least get something out of points wise. And then, you know, if there's enough, there should be enough points out of those 2 matches that you would hope that the Munster game, again, you don't know what Munster are doing. If Munster have a home tie all sewn up, we don't know what they're going to do in terms of the team they pick. So I think based on what's going on in other provinces and Scarlett's being a bit of a basket case, Ulster should have enough for the top 8.
You like it, Fergus?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the league table here. It is concerningly stacked around that kind of 5th all the way down to 10th. So, but yeah, I think we'll beat Scarlets, and that will put us in a good footing. And we're maybe relying on the fact that Leinster will put a weakened side up the road, but if they do that, it's hard to predict too far in front because you also don't know. Ulster hopefully will have players coming back from injury. They never tell you who's available and who's not, but hopefully I'll be slightly stronger. So I think 2 wins out of 3 should be a fairly comfortable top 8. So I'll go along with that. Anything from Munster is a bonus.
Yeah, and Ian?
Yeah, I'm in agreement with the guys. I had a look earlier in the week there, responded to Ulster fan Derry Gasman on Twitter, who asked the question and then provided the final fixtures for each team. And I had a look at that, and I think that we'll probably finish seventh in there. From my calculations anyway, I'm looking at a win in Llanelli in Saturday week. And then, as Nathan has said, if Leinster are still involved, as we would expect them to be in the Champions Cup, we could be seeing their South Africa type side coming up to Belfast the week after, and that would give us a good chance for maybe 4 points, and I think that will be enough. Not expecting to get anything against Munster, because I think for the last game, Munster may well be playing for a top two, which will give them home quarter and semi-final.
I forgot, but Leinster have just been knocked off top perch, so they actually might not, even if they are in the Champions Cup final, look, they're not going to send the big guns out, but there's a scenario here where Leinster can't actually afford to lose that game if they're also fighting for top two, having just been beaten by Glasgow, and if Munster keep winning out, and even if the Bulls keep winning, they're only 3 points behind them. So maybe they don't send their South Africa team, but you know they won't. You know they might.
No,
play.
Not, they won't. They certainly won't capitulate. My calculation was having them finishing third, Nathan, actually, because I think Munster can end up finishing second in that league.
They won't want that.
No, Leinster won't want it. Of course they won't. Obviously that will affect the game against us in Belfast. But I still think in Belfast, get a win against Scarlets. Again, confidence is going to be boosted a wee bit. Perhaps some of the more experienced players back. It'll be a good game. It'll definitely be a good game.
Be an interesting end of the season, and as I said at the start, nerve-wracking times ahead. And what do we learn from the pod? I think we learned that there's going to be tough on certain times ahead, but it'll be entertaining. And isn't that the most important thing? The answer is no. No, it'll be entertaining, but we'll support the team and Softom the whole way, because I think it is exciting what they're building. And I can get behind the Richie Murphy project and the Hugh McCackie or someone in that mould at the helm. So, like, I'm excited. I really enjoyed being back at the Kingspan for the first time in a long time on Friday there. So, we'll be covering every moment of Ulster action on the Red Hand. And we'll be back next week, all being well. I'm running the marathon on Sunday, so I'm raising money for Macmillan Cancer Support. So, like, if anyone wants to donate, it's on the socials. So, if I survive, we'll be back next week. I should caveat that. And so, yeah, any donations, much appreciated. So, thanks so much to Brendan. Great to have you, Brendan. Thank you for your insight and. Really enjoyed having you. To Nathan, Fergus, and Ian, and thank you for listening.